From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We don't know yet exactly what happened between 18-year-old Michael Brown and police officer Darren Wilson on that street in Ferguson, Missouri. We do know that Ferguson's streets have filled in the days since with people quite determined to make a statement about the state of affairs in this country, to beg for and demand a bigger conversation about race and class and justice in this country. Okay, let's have it. This hour on Point, the message out of Ferguson and its challenge to how we live and regard our fellow Americans. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you read Ferguson? What's the message? What's the right response? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We've heard lots of voices on those streets in Ferguson saying, listen, pay attention. There's something that we're talking about here, something we're pointing to that's important. Sometimes it looks like a way back machine.
You have a picture from 2014 and a picture from 1960, and they're looking damn near identical. They got the dogs out. And there's a problem. You telling me we ain't made no progress? In 50 years? My mom and them marched with Martin Luther King. You know what I'm saying? Where's the progress?
18-year-old Michael Brown down and people asking big questions around that death. On Monday night, a Time camera crew stayed with a group of protesters as they voiced their anger and decided whether or not to remain in Ferguson streets after the curfew. One protester spoke to race and socioeconomic class issues, dividing authorities and the people on the streets.
They want people to pay $275 for child support a month. If you don't, they put you in jail. Then they want you to bond out, let you back out, so you can go out here and do something crazy and wind up back in jail. You talking to a little movement that went through it. For real. I did years in the penitentiary. It ain't about no bragging rights. We got to get it together. But until then, we going to act up on them because they acting up on us. We can't get it right till they get it right.
Let's get it right. What would that mean? Joining me now from St. Louis is Patricia Bynes, Democratic committeewoman in Ferguson Township. She's been out in the streets of Ferguson every night talking with protesters and police. Committeewoman Bynes, Patricia, thank you very much for making time for us today at On Point.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me.
With us from Rancho Mirage, California, we're joined by Malcolm London, a young poet, educator, and activist out of Chicago. He works with Young Chicago Authors and the Northwestern Bloom Legal Clinic. He was a guest on our show in March. We're glad to have him back. Sorry it's in tough circumstances like this. But Malcolm London, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Philadelphia, we are joined by Yahuru Williams, professor of history at Fairfield University in Connecticut and author of several books, including Black Politics, White Power. Yahuru Williams, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
We're okay. We're trying to make sense, trying to respond to what we're seeing in the streets of Ferguson. Patricia Bynes, you've spent more time than any of us there. What do you see as the big message? What should the country be taking away from these days and nights of protest and more in Ferguson?
Well, I think what's going on in the streets of Ferguson is really what's going on around the country. We have issues of racism, and they're fueling the disconnect between the community and law enforcement as far as prejudices and biases. You see anger about being racially profiled. What you're hearing and seeing is anger about police harassment. And you can see for yourselves the effects of excessive force in trying to police this community. And people are tired. It's just incredible to think that and somehow there's an 18-year-old that's dead who was unarmed, you know, just due to an incident of walking in the street. And people are tired because the way that Mike Brown was killed, it was in broad daylight. And enough is enough.
Patricia, there are big issues here, and we'll come to them, but let's stick with the issue that's got everything started here, the killing of Michael Brown.
Correct.
You say he was killed just walking in the street. We don't know if it was quite as simple as that, right? There are all kinds of accounts of exactly what happened there. How much of this conversation, to your mind, should hinge around the exact events of what happened with Michael Brown and Officer Darren Wilson?
Well, we don't know all of the exact details, but to think that an unarmed man could come away with six shots in him, two in the head, is unbelievable. That should not happen. Unfortunately, in the black community, this happens far too often, and we don't get answers. People feel like when this happens to young black men and women, it's swept underneath the rug or it's covered up. And this community has had enough of it because too many people saw what happened. The way that an ambulance was never called for Mike Brown, and his body laid out in the street for four and a half hours.
That's incredible, yeah.
That's incredible. It's gotten to a level that it's almost like there's just an... It's done with such boldness that this was it.
Malcolm London, you're a Chicago guy, a young Chicago guy. You were watching from Chicago and then driving across the country as Ferguson's drama unfolded. What's the message you're reading out of Ferguson, Malcolm?
First of all, I want to say thank you to Patricia, because I believe a lot of politicians should take note that this is what you do for the people. And so I appreciate you being out there in the streets and other folks who are down there in Ferguson. But I think for me, I mean, it is what folks need to understand is that the black community has always been brutalized by the entity that is the police, right, which is the state for a long time. I mean, from infiltration from back in the 70s with COINTELPRO, up until now, when every 28 hours in this country, a black person is shot down by a police officer or a self-appointed vigilante. And so what does that mean when so blatantly you murder an 18-year-old boy in the street, leave his body laying there, and then put him in an SUV, not even an ambulance, and then you say, after we kill your young people, you can't be upset about it. And when you are, we will send tanks to control the situation, as if people don't have the right to assemble and or the right to be upset at this constant brutalizing of black bodies. And
not tanks yet, we should specify, but it's been some pretty heavy equipment in the streets there. Juan Williams used to be with NPR, now does a lot for Fox, pointing out today that 90% of the young black men killed by gunfire in this country are not killed by police, but by other black men. There's been a lot of that kind of response to this. Right. Not least on Juan's new home, Fox. What do you say about that troubling number, though, Malcolm?
Well, I think here also is a troubling number. 84% of the white people who are killed are also killed by white people. And so those numbers are a lot higher as well. And so in this country, a lot of folks try to combat this, you know, the discrimination and generations of racism that happens and continues to happen against black people with that number or that rhetoric of black on black crime. When you say black on black crime, you racialize crime. When in America, there's more white people, meaning more white people commit more crimes. However, black people fill up prisons and are arrested more and more. So in the media, when you say, well, black on black crime is a thing, or, you know, look at how they are killing each other, you racialize this thing of crime when you and it sort of, you know, points at this subculture that must exist among black folks instead of pointing to the real issues of poverty and mass incarceration or conditions that create people to hurt one another. You know, perpetrators of violence don't drive, you know, halfway across the city to go release their frustrations. They hurt people who are next to them. And we in America are still very segregated. I'm from Chicago.
Yep.
And it's one of the most segregated cities in the nation. And so when you talk about, you know, where are all the black folks? South and West Side's neighborhoods are hurting. They're hurting from school closures. They're hurting from lack of investment. They're hurting from no jobs. I think, don't quote me on the statistic, but I think it's almost nearly 90% of black youth in Chicago have no available, are unemployed, right? And so when you don't invest in jobs, when you don't invest in young people in general, you know, there's a sort of desperation that exists and a condition that exists in which people start to hurt one another. And so that is the – so then when you take away this rhetoric of black-on-black crime, you look at the real issues that affect neighborhoods. And so in neighborhoods across the country. But then When you point out 90% of or whatever that fact,
yes.
You know, I could also say the same thing, but we don't talk about white on white crime in the same way.
Malcolm Linden, hold the thought. I want to get Yahuru in before the break here. Professor Williams, we have heard people in the streets of Ferguson talking a lot about race, talking about justice, talking about policing there. We've also heard them look more broadly beyond black and white at class in this country, class issues. How do you read the messages coming out of Ferguson, Professor Williams?
It's a long time coming in a lot of ways, Tom, and we've been seeing this for several years in the African-American community in particular, where you have people who want to have a conversation about the black underclass and to talk about crime and other problems associated with the black underclass as if they are separate from the black community as a whole. Yesterday, you had a reporter for the Wall Street Journal talk about advising Eric Holder to tell the young men, and you know, as he goes out there, to tell the young men in Ferguson to pull their pants up. You have this discourse about black-on-black crime, the comments of Juan Williams. And you have, going back a couple of years, the comments of Bill Cosby talking about, again, the black underclass. The problem with this is that two things. Number one, you don't have the opportunity for constructive grief in this particular case because we're mourning the loss of an 18-year-old under circumstances that should be investigated. And if it's determined that Darren Wilson is complicit, then he should be prosecuted vigorously. And then you have these separate issues that wind their way into the conversation and in a lot of ways obscure our ability to talk about the real issues here: race, justice, and structural inequality.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the message in, the message out of Ferguson, the meaning of the uproar. Here from last night, the sound of police telling protesters they had to leave the area or face arrest in Ferguson, Missouri. And here, protesters, they are political. They see it as political, chanting here in the name of democracy as two of them got too close to police and were arrested. Show me what democracy looks like, and they don't want to see arrests attached to that. Not the protest part of it, anyway. Here's protester Jeremy Roan last night telling reporters he came out from St. Louis to join the protest because he wants to send a message that things need to change.
I'm a father. I have two boys. No way am I going to raise them to be in fear of the very people who they pay to protect them.
So, we're talking about the message out of Ferguson with Patricia Bynes, Democratic committeewoman from Ferguson Township, joining us from St. Louis. Chicagoan Malcolm Linden is with us. He's at the Northwestern Bloom Legal Clinic there, the Young Chicago Authors a group there, poet, educator, advocate. Yahuru Williams is with us, professor of history in Fairfield, Connecticut, author of Black Politics, White Power. Let's get our listeners right in here. And Patricia, Malcolm, Yahuru, will come to you. Rebecca in Bellbuckle, Tennessee. You're on the air, Rebecca.
Hi, Tom. I just really believe and feel like I know that it's scary to be black in America and be approached by a police officer. And I had an experience in the last month where I had gone to a friend of mine's house for dinner, and her husband is a police officer who I know and have talked to many times. And the TV was on, and all of a sudden he said out loud, "I am sick of blacks." And it totally shocked me, because I'd never heard him say anything like this.
What do you think he meant by that exactly, Rebecca?
He just said he was sick of them. I asked him, I'm like, why would you say that? And he said, I'm sick of how they think we owe them something. I'm sick of their pants being down. I'm sick of, you know, all this, everything's always because they're black, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so the thing that scared me was, you know, he trains and conducts roadblocks in Tennessee. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is exactly not what we want a police officer's attitude to be when he's stopping black people to see if there's a problem or not.
Rebecca, I appreciate your call. Let us pick it up right there, if I may. We've got a new survey that's come out since Ferguson. Yahuru Williams, this is from the Pew Center, and it found they asked the question about whether Ferguson raises important issues about race. 80% of black respondents said yes. 37% of white respondents said yes, and you heard what Rebecca heard over dinner there. What do you take from that, Yahuru?
It's a sense of denial. What you have are people who are buying into the narrative that we're in a post-racial moment, that we have an African-American president, an African-American attorney general, a Latina on the U.S. Supreme Court, and somehow that translates into us having moved beyond the issues of race and structural inequality that require us to dialogue and talk about some of these problems as they manifest themselves in communities like Ferguson. Part of the problem, I think, when you look at numbers like that is they indicate that on the part of the African-American community, black and brown people, a very real perception that even though we talk about participatory democracy, even though we extol the virtues of the United States Constitution and talk about our system of fairness and our system of justice, every day people confront inequalities, microaggressions, so to speak, that let them know what their place is in the society as a whole. When it takes people to be in a situation where they have to protest in the streets in order to have transparency from police, that's a significant problem in a democracy. And it's partly the police are to blame partly for this, but also our larger society. We need to be honest with ourselves about what it means to be black in America. We need to be honest with ourselves about what it means to have an earnest and honest dialogue about race. Divorce from the politics of respectability, where the argument is, well, if Michael Brown had his pants were up, or if he had, you know, been someplace else or behaved this way, this wouldn't have happened. That's not the discussion that we need to be having. We need to be talking about the value of human life. We need to be talking about, regardless of what color Michael Brown is, having a justice system that treats people fairly and having American citizens not feel like they're constantly under a cloud of suspicion because of the color of their skin.
Patricia Bynes, I understand exactly what Professor Williams is pointing at there, but our caller from Bellbuckle, Tennessee, the policeman she had dinner with in a private moment, he wasn't saying we're in a post-racial paradise here. He said, mm-hmm. I'm sick of blacks. And,
right.
And I wonder what you read in that. Put yourself in the policeman's shoes. What's being expressed there?
Well, I don't know. And I'm not going to frame all of our officers as in feeling like that.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. So we can start at the very individual level. I don't know why he would be sick of blacks. I don't know what would make him say that. But when she got to talking about it, feel like... I believe the statement was they feel like they're owed something. Black people aren't looking for any more than what anybody else is looking for at this point. We would like to be able to walk the streets without being harassed. We would like to be able to be spoken to respectfully when we interact with law enforcement. I don't think that these are huge, life-shattering, you owe me $1 million of reparations type of requests.
Mm-hmm.
These are just some of the basics that seem to be missing with interaction between the African-American community and law enforcement all too often. And I want to stress, not all the time, but too often there are a lot of bad apples that on both sides
mm-hmm.
that make the interaction difficult. So it's not being owed something, but there's a level of just basic human respect that seems to be missing, because far too often in the black community, even when we call 911, we wind up somehow being harassed or disrespected by the same officers that we call. So that there's a real problem there, and that needs to stop, because when you have someone with that type of authority, which has access to sensitive information and weapons, you know, there's a huge level of intimidation there. And it's gone on for far too long. So nobody's looking for anything more than anybody else, because I have, you know, several white friends, and some of them just do not understand the concept of, hey, oftentimes when we call the police, we could wind up being arrested too, or not spoken to properly.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get that concept. So for many, the status quo is fine. They don't see what the issue is because it doesn't affect them the way it does us.
Atlanta, Georgia, Gene is calling. Gene, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How you people doing?
All right, thanks.
The lady was just talking about one of the issues that I have trouble with. I think there are two separate issues, and one, of course, is the legal issue. Was the cop right or was the cop wrong? But on the other side, she was just talking about respect and how the community needs certain things. And to me, this video shows that Mr. Brown was part of the problem. he was that microaggressor towards the store owners. And we always say we need more store owners and we need more of this in our community. When we have this type of actions in our community.
You're talking about the video of Michael Brown apparently sort of pushing around the convenience store owner before the death.
Right. Businesses don't want to come to our community when we have these type of microaggressions. So I don't think he is the poster boy for these demonstrations. Now, of course, I say there's two separate issues. Of course, the cop, if he was right, justified is one thing. If he was unjustified, that's another. That's the legal issue. But the broader point with all these demonstrations,
yep.
This is not it just does not seem like the case for this, because he is one of those, well, he was one of the people that I would think that we would want to change. We grow up, leave, do something, because that is the exact problem in our communities where you have young people mostly going in and saying, you know, this is my turf.
Well, I mean, that wasn't a pretty moment in the convenience store. On the other hand, he finished high school. He was headed off, we're told, to vocational school, some kind of college there. Malcolm London, Patricia Bynes says, give us respect in our community. Gene in Atlanta says, that's got to be a two-way street. What do you say, Malcolm?
I think, first of all, in this country, I think here's the issue. There's an 18-year-old dead and body left in the street for 4 hours. Please tell me what can you do to deserve that? And that is part of the issue, is that when a black body ends up dead, we come to the defense of whomever murdered a young person. I mean, we see that, like, what can you deserve? What can you do to deserve that? I don't know too many people who can. And then, like you said, Tom, I mean, this young man was all on his way to college, and now he can't do that. And now he can't go out into society and fulfill his dreams. And at the issue, now we have a dead teenager.
Well, I mean, what the police are saying or intimating here is that he was reaching for the officer's gun. We don't know exactly what happened, but that's their answer, sort of informally to your question.
I don't know any black person, sane person in America who will try to reach for a police officer's weapon, because especially not anyone who looks like me or is around my age, because that is a scary situation just to be approached by police. But also,
can I underscore something Malcolm's saying there too, Tom, in this sense? It's interesting that the caller, Gene, would suggest that it's permissible to execute someone for shoplifting. At the end of the day, you're talking about a response that's disproportionate to the crime. In Connecticut a couple of years ago, there was a woman who received 12 years in jail for stealing educational services. In San Francisco, you had a 19-year-old in 2011 who shot to death. And later, the police come back and say he was a murder suspect, but he was shot for not paying a bus fare. Is this the new Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander talked about? Are these the new black codes? And when Malcolm speaks so eloquently and Patricia speaks so eloquently about what's happening in the streets of Ferguson, what they're underscoring is a problem that's national. And this is how African-Americans perceive this. There's, you know, the Kerner Commission said it in 1967, and it's still true today. There are two societies, separate and unequal, and largely black and white.
And it's not just an issue of respect. I want to be fair to Gene. I don't think he quite said it's fine to execute someone for shoplifting. He said there are two different issues here. He's talking about respect, but there's an envelope around this. I mean, you go all the way back to 1972, and the jobless rate among African-Americans more than double that among whites. Last year, same. All those years, and it's still twice as much unemployment there. And that's just at the race level. Before we get to class, Josh in Dothan, Alabama. Josh, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, I just wanted to make a statement about profiling once again. I know it's a very, very old thing. It's been going on I've seen it with my own two eyes for at least 10 years. And here in Dothan, Alabama, the city police, and I work for the city, so I know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
The city police that work the night shift, they're told specifically at night to look out, you know, be wary of men wearing the Elmer Fudd hat, is what they call it, the flat brim baseball cap.
Yep.
You know, and, I can only speak for the place where I live at. And it's also known, like, if you're a white male and you're inside of a vehicle, I have a friend who's a promoter at some nightclubs around here. We promote local hip-hop events and stuff. And but it's known, if you're a black guy inside of a vehicle with a white guy and the cops drive by, they're going to be hawking you down, you know, to see if there's some, because there has to be some type of suspicious drug activity going on. As far as the class issue goes, you know, when I first moved here, I stayed on the outskirts of the of what they call the bottom, one of the major housing projects.
Yep.
And walking to my mentor's house, mm-hmm. or, you know, people who were helping me get on my feet.
Sure.
I would search at night. If it was after dark, if it was, I say, if it was after 10 p.m., I would be searched for riding my bicycle or walking with my bicycle after riding my bicycle a couple miles. You know, I'd be searched for no reason, but I guarantee if I lived inside of a subdivision, a suburb area in this city, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be asked any questions for walking at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah. Josh, I appreciate your witness on several fronts there. I appreciate your call from Dothan, Alabama. And Patricia Bynes, you heard Josh's story. You know, Peniel Joseph takes that in Newsweek magazine essay there, says that what she has seen in Ferguson reminds her of all the way back in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, back when Dr. King was in jail, writing his letter from Birmingham jail, arguing, you know, talking about Jim Crow segregation and all the rest. She says, or he says, I should, Peniel Joseph, the tear-gassing violence and military-style police presence directed against black citizens in Ferguson is part of a larger pattern of political repression against the African-American community. Does that go too far, Committeewoman Bynes?
No, I don't think so at all. Unfortunately, in the actual city of Ferguson, it's a majority African-American city, but as far as the elected officials that represent it, the mayor is white. The county council, there's only one African American on the city council for that area.
But listeners might say, if it's majority African American, why don't they come out and elect from their ranks to fill those positions?
Exactly. So,
well, what's the answer?
The answer is the same answer that goes on all across America, is that people of a certain socioeconomic level, they don't participate in the political process as much. They're worried about, can I get a job? Can I walk home safely? Can I get to work today when election day comes? They don't participate. And then when blacks do get involved in the political process, the fundraising, they're often shut out of fundraising, and you need money in order to run for office. So if your base and the people who are backing you aren't financed very well, you're not going to have a really good shot at running for office. So there are all sorts of dynamics on why there aren't as many African Americans involved. But hopefully this issue will get people more involved at the municipal level, because I have always said, there's huge money that goes around in the national elections. You know, millions of dollars are raised for president. So you see those ads. But the lower, the municipal and more local elections, they don't raise as much money in them. And they're not always running ads and in your face. And so people tend not to pay as much attention to them. But they have the most effect on your everyday life. And I think that the citizens of this municipality are paying attention to that. And there will be a change.
Did you see, before Michael Brown's shooting, was this part of the conversation in Ferguson? People talking about political repression, race, class? Or is it just since the shooting?
No. We've had some very contentious political activity in the community within this past year, a school board race. Everyone was focused on school board race. Since there's been an influx of African Americans in the community, mm-hmm. education's been a big issue.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the message out of Ferguson. Patricia Bynes with us from St. Louis. Malcolm London of Chicago with us. Yahuru Williams with us from Fairfield, Connecticut, professor of history there. What do you see? How do you read Ferguson? Here's the president Monday night on Ferguson.
In too many communities, too many young men of color are left behind and seen only as objects of fear. And through initiatives like My Brother's Keeper, I'm personally committed to changing both perception and reality. And already we're making some significant progress, as people of goodwill of all races are ready to chip in. But that requires that we build and not tear down. And that requires we listen and not just shout. That's how we're going to move forward together.
As the president, that's how we're going to move forward together. Build, don't tear down. Malcolm London, when you hear the president with that kind of message, do you feel him, hear him fully at grips with what we're seeing, sort of blazing on the table here out of Ferguson?
So there's two things. First, during the record, I did a little bit of research of my own, but I wanted to confirm, but the officer, the police chief said that the officer did not know or that Brown was a quote-unquote suspect in
the
robbery.
That's correct. That's
right. He stopped him in the street. However, we're kind of already talking as if he's assumed criminal as opposed to
the video's been out there, and the officer was very clear that they didn't know he was a suspect, but they showed the video right after they talked about who the police officer was. So there's a kind of, guilt by association suggestion there. But that's different from the fact we don't know exactly what happened on the scene, certainly.
Yeah, someone's dead, and a police officer is not arrested. That's what I do know.
Yeah.
However, I think that what the president said, I think there's also an issue I have is that when black folks in this country, which we've constantly experienced some kind of oppressive or excessive force, whether from the law or from the state, when we are, when we experience that, we're told to be docile, to be, to relax about it, and to not shout and to not tear things down, and specifically tear things down in which we've helped build for the past 600 years. And so I think that I feel really, apprehensive about when folks tell, especially people of color, not to be upset or to be calm about the oppression that they are facing, as opposed to, every other day I hear about, folks who don't share my skin with guns and, can talk about their right to carry guns and walk the streets. And I think that is an issue that is also apparent. But I also think that we shouldn't look to, as an organizer with an organization called BYP 100, it's a national organization of 18 to 35 year olds. We, are working not only in Chicago, but nationally around trying to hold our local police, as Patricia pointed out, accountable and our local politicians. Those are the folks that we need to hold accountable to us and organize around, not specifically the president who, while as commander-in-chief, could easily, I think, have a hand in the situation in Ferguson, as he does, across the globe. However, I think it's important as an organizer that we remember across for everyone in every city that we locally have to begin to organize as to find solutions as to, although, on a very political sense, this issue is bigger than just, paper and laws. This is clearly a cultural shift that needs to begin to happen.
And numbers still tell a big story. I mean, all these years after the civil rights movement, 12.7% poverty among whites. That's bad. But among blacks, 27.2%, more than double. Got a lot of response here online. Rajesh says, I run, walk down the street. Can't fathom I could get killed for that. Also, never been referred to as an animal, quote unquote. Geraldine writes to us, unfortunately, it takes a riot to get attention. We hope not. We wish not. But, and Joe DeMatos writes, this is socioeconomic. All the people, Joe writes, on the bottom side of the ladder are faced with police brutality. That's a pretty broad brush, but it's what Joe feels. Rock in New Orleans, Louisiana. Rock, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is such a complicated issue. I live in one of the most diverse, integrated cities in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fortunate because I get to go through both sides of our community and also the community that's very joined, black and white.
I mean, racially, you're some of both. Okay.
I look like a white guy, blonde hair and blue eyes.
Yep.
My mother was Creole.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
I work in the neighborhood, St. Rock neighborhood, that's very, very black. So I get to see and interact with people who always treat me kindly in both communities, but I do see racism. And the racism from white people is from fear. In the neighborhood where I work, There's a lot of shootings. There's a lot of crime. Recently, we had a rash of beatings of middle-aged white guys, of which I'm one, but I don't let myself go into the fear. And I think that what everybody needs to do in this kind of a situation is take a deep breath and just look at the humanity involved, that we're all people here. And I think people start viewing others not as human beings, but as a black guy and as a white guy. And it is extremely difficult. Sometimes I'm fearful myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fearful. And I see some young black man walking, and I go, should I be afraid of him? And I take a deep breath, and I say, okay, I'm not going to put myself in some crazy situation, but I say hello instead. And it's very complicated.
Yeah.
There's crime, a lot of crime, and I know it's not proper to say black on black, but young teenage men kill each other here. And when that happens, I think there should be just as much outrage as there is in Ferguson, because somebody's getting killed for really no reason whatsoever.
Rock, you are wise and humane, and I appreciate that. It's hard to turn that into a national attitude. Yes, is that you, Yahuru?
It is. And Tom, I think there is outrage. We saw this recently in Chicago with the rash of shootings. Yeah. There's outrage in the African-American community. There are people like Malcolm and others who've made the case that we need to address these issues, and the nation doesn't pay attention. It takes something like Ferguson, unfortunately, to raise it to the level where it's racialized, where people want to pay attention, even though you have voices clamoring for this type of intervention on the part of government and on people in general, just to recognize that we face a grave problem with regard to our future generations if we allow this type of violence to continue to proliferate. It was something the president said that I thought was interesting in talking about Iraq. He said, we've got a national security interest in making sure our people are protected and in making sure that the savage group that seems willing to slaughter people for no rhyme or reason, other than that they've not kowtowed to that group, is contained.
He's talking about the Islamic State ISIS there.
He was. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to hear him say, we've got a domestic security interest in making sure that all people are protected and making sure that one group, and in this case, it's the police. And we're not painting all police with a broad brush. But what we're saying is, in the same way that Rock talks about having fear of young African-American males, there are African-Americans who have deep respect and mistrust of the police, given the historic injustice that's been associated with policing in this country. So really, we're talking about a conversation. We're talking about these types of interventions. But, you know, the perception always is that, well, the white community has something to fear from black crime, without looking or taking into account that the majority of these instances in these types of cases involve young African-American males and that there's fear on both sides. So a conversation is important and an intervention is important, but it's one that has to take into account the class dynamic. You mentioned the civil rights movement earlier, and Peniel wrote that great article in Newsweek, but in his final book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King wrote, what good is it to have the right to eat in a restaurant if you can't afford anything on the menu? What good is it to have the right to go to college if you can't anticipate that you're going to be able to make a living once you do? That is Michael Brown. It's one thing to say he's going to college. Does he have a summer job that is going to give him the opportunity not to have to steal? And again, not making excuses for the victim, but just saying, as we say that this is complicated, we're in that moment again and asking this question, 12% poverty in the white community, 22% plus in the black community.
27,
excuse me. Where do we go from here? Chaos or community?
Yeah. Gail in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Gail, thank you for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
I should start by saying that I am a liberal and I embrace the word. And I am dismayed by the way in which supposedly responsible media has had a knee-jerk response to Ferguson.
What response are you looking at, Gail?
Of course it's complicated, but it's been portrayed as bad white cop, unarmed black teenager. There was initially no attempt to get the whole story, much less to suggest that there might be one. No attention whatsoever to say that everyone has constitutional rights, including the policeman. At times justifying and minimalizing the looting and violence against the police, excusing Michael Brown's assaulting the clerk, which, you know, he was twice the guy's size.
Hey, I haven't heard an excuse. Nobody thinks that's pretty, and I think everybody was clamoring to know what happened on the street. Right? Everybody wanted to know what happened with the policeman.
I heard justice as voiced by both protesters and the media, meaning vengeance. And if we throw out the fact that we're a nation of laws, what do we have? It's not a perfect system, and a lot of the time it doesn't work for the powerless, but let's fix it, not trash it.
Hey, Gail, I hear you've got a law and order message there, But what, and that's very important. Everybody wants to, justice for exactly what happened there, I believe.
What?
But let me just ask Gail, if I may. Gail, what about this, the bigger envelope around this? I mean, people in the streets of Ferguson are talking a lot about Malcolm Brown and Darryl Wilson, but they're also talking about our economy, our culture, the class problems
absolutely.
In this country. Shouldn't we take those on?
Of course we should, but we're not doing it. The media is sensationalizing this. They are not. Why is there not wall-to-wall coverage of the killings that are not white on black? There are just as many young black men dead. There are just as many dead as Michael Brown.
I see those numbers all the time on the news. Everybody knows there were 50 killings in a weekend in Chicago. We heard a lot about that. But I don't know. Gail, we will pick it up. Malcolm, what do you say to that? Or Patricia, please.
I'll come to you.
You're there.
May I interject? Because
yes, please.
I live here.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of black-on-black crime is very different than the issue of when law enforcement is using excessive force and incidents happen where people die when they should not. That's a misuse of authority, and it's a very different nuance. They're here to serve and protect, and somehow we are a community that's not being served or protected. We seem to be the victims of way too often of misuse. So I don't think that there's anything that's being sensationalized from the coverage that I've seen. I think that they are showing the story. So when we talk about excessive force, police brutality, and there's people protesting, and we have officers that, you know, they show up in complete full riot gear. I personally have ran away from two SWAT trucks throwing flash grenades, you know, at me. Mm. And it's kind of like, what is going on
mm-hmm.
here? What the media is doing is putting it on display. You can watch as much or as little of it as you'd like. You can, when you go to the media, you can go to whoever has the slant. But the main issue here is the issue of law enforcement and its interaction with the black community, and why do so many who are stopped, who are black, wind up being shot? There was either another officer-involved shooting in the city of North St. Louis yesterday. So there's nothing that's being sensationalized here, because if you want to get into the looting, those are stores that I go to. The people that work there are people who I interact with. And a lot of that is coming from people who are not in this area. But if we can focus on the issue of how does a young man who is unarmed, you say he went for the officer's gun.
I don't know that, but it's been said by the police in Ferguson.
He's unarmed. And he shot, apparently, with his hands up in the air. How does that happen? How does he get two shots in his head? How does that happen?
Yeah.
That should not happen.
Can I add to that, Patricia?
Because
I think it's important, too, that, you know, we have a situation where in 1967, people were shocked to see the National Guard in the streets of Detroit, Michigan. But here in 2014, we have police, at least that was the National Guard, who are armed to the teeth because we have a militarized police force. When the caller calls in and talks about a law enforcement or law and order mentality, if the fruition of that is to have American cities that look more like Beirut than Baltimore, we have a problem. This is not what this country is founded on. It undermines participatory democracy. It embarrasses us in the eyes of the world. And it makes us appear that although we profess to have these values of justice and liberty, freedom of speech, the right to petition for grievance, they only apply when one shade or one class of people is involved.
Malcolm, I'll come to you. I want to get one more. Adam in Nashville. And I'll come to you, Malcolm. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think the situation in Ferguson highlights a greater issue in our country, and that's the actions of people should benefit society. And examples of that is that situations with personal rights and stand your ground, businesses and paying low wages, the government and the actions in Ferguson, our justice system, all work against that. The purpose of society is to benefit everyone. If there's not going to be a benefit of society, then what's the point of it all? And I think that's what happens when you see disenfranchised neighborhoods like that that don't get any benefit.
Well, you're looking at our shrinking middle class and all the rest there, Adam.
Right. Yeah, it's a greater crux of an issue. It's permeating through all of American society. And I think people need to understand that the point of society is to benefit everybody.
Adam, our time is short. Malcolm London, you know, a lot of people have been doing just fine, but a lot of people have not. And part of what Ferguson seems to be saying is, hey, folks, the status quo is not okay. And, of course, that's hard to hear.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to address quickly. I'm going to try to do this.
Got a minute and a half.
Okay. The fear of the black body in this country is, especially from white people, I think is an entirely irrational one. One, because, again, the numbers do not lie. White people in this country commit more crimes and lead in the majority of those crimes. However, you don't get to hear, you know, what would that sound like if every, you know, young black people have a very rationalized historical fear of people who are white and in positions of power. That is a real thing. However, in our current situation, we're afraid of, you know, people who look like me and are my age, when those who, you know, the scariest moment for me in Chicago is the night that the Blackhawks won or after Lollapalooza. However, there's no increased police force there because most of those people don't look like me, but they loot and they commit crimes and they wild out and do a lot of things. And then I want to say this, though. As a country, what we need to do is not look at law and order and punitive ways of justice. We need to start to redefine what does justice look like. Because even Darren Williams going to prison isn't justice for all black youth across this country who will again continue to experience the same deaths and the same type of police brutality. We need to reimagine what justice and love looks like.
We won't finish this conversation, but it's important to be on it, and we're on it, and I appreciate all of you helping us with that. Malcolm London, 21, out of Chicago in California today. Malcolm, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Yahuru Williams at Fairfield University, Connecticut. Thank you so much, Professor Williams.
Tom, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
And Patricia Bynes, Democratic Committeewoman of Ferguson Township. She has been on the street. Good luck with your community, Committeewoman.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.